Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join us on the exchange, feel free. Phone number is here, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Spend any time with commercial media, and that includes the internet, and you'll be barraged with messages urging you to buy products that will make your life better, or softer, or smoother, or faster. Pick the adjective. It's compelling. Compelling enough to get millions and millions of people buying things they may not need. What do you call it when you seek the good life and then don't feel so good when you get the trappings of that life? Today's guest calls it affluenza. John DeGraff spent more than two decades now talking about consumption in America through documentaries on PBS and books under that same general heading, affluenza. John DeGraff is the co-founder of the Happiness Initiative in Seattle and the executive director of Take Back Your Time, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So what sequence of events led you to take a broad view, and I suppose a dim view at that, of consumerism?
Well, you know, I've always wondered about it, from way back, that we were paying much more attention to growing and growing and consuming and spending more and more and less attention to the quality of life. And that has a lot to do with how we measure our success as a country, since we use the gross domestic product, which is really a measure of how much we buy and sell in the course of a year. And that's what supposedly tells us how well we're doing. But the sense that I was having was that even though we were growing and spending and consuming more and more, we were doing a lot of damage to our health and to our social connections, and certainly threatening the environment in many ways.
Which leads me to jump right ahead to a question about what you do when Thanksgiving weekend approaches and whether you pay any attention to the news media about that time.
Well, I pay some grim attention to the news media when I hear that people are trampling over each other on Black Friday or even on Thursday now because they've extended Thanksgiving shopping hours to Thanksgiving, which is truly absurd. So that, you know, one person was killed this year at Walmart. Several people were killed last year from people stampeding to get at products. It's pretty crazy. Other than that, I try not to pay too much attention to it at that time of year because it seems to me a rather gross display of greed and foolish in terms of many, many things if we're looking at happiness and we're looking at sustainability.
You've been talking about affluenza for more than 20 years now, though, correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, affluenza as a term, which I didn't make up, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's been around in the, you know, since probably about 1954, but I think I can take credit with my colleagues for having popularized it. We actually made the film Affluenza in 96. It came out on PBS in 97. So that's what, 17 years ago. And then I co-wrote the book in 2000. That came out in 2001. And the third edition of the book, Affluenza, is about to hit the bookstores as we speak.
I understand that, yeah. So it's just early next month, is that right?
Well, it's officially early next month, but it'll be in bookstores before that. But I think Amazon can't start selling it, and it can't be sold online, or people can't receive it until February 3rd. Mm-hmm. So, it can be sold, but...
Okay, got it. So what was the response to that first PBS documentary like back when it aired in the mid-90s?
Well, it was kind of my Andy Warhol 15 minutes of fame. I've never had that sort of response to any documentary I had done before or since, sadly. But the nice thing about it was that millions of people saw that show. The response to PBS was very strong and led PBS to actually broadcast the show four times in core time, at 9 o'clock at night on a weeknight, which is fairly rare. Ken Burns gets that, but I hadn't had four prime time core slots before with one show. So the estimate is that somewhere between 10 and 15 million people watch the show on air in those broadcasts. And then there was a lot of excitement about it from colleges and universities and churches and so forth. So the distribution of the film beyond television was done by Bullfrog Films. And for Bullfrog Films, it's been the best-selling film of their entire history of some 35 years of selling films.
Given the context, though, and the huge reaction to it and the fact that many people did respond to it, I mean, would you think that perhaps some of the concepts would have been a little more broadly embraced by this point in history?
Well, I think they're embraced by some people. The problem is that, you know, even 10, 15 million is not a lot of people compared to what commercial media is reaching on a regular basis with these constant barrage of ads and other things. And, you know, people tend to get excited for a short time, and they you know, have all sorts of resolutions about saving and doing things. And then the patterns begin to reassert themselves because there is simply so much pressure to the contrary coming from our media and our society telling us we need to grow. In fact, the book Affluenza, believe it or not, actually had as a publishing date September 11th, 2001.
I noticed that, yes.
Yeah, and it was an interesting thing because, of course, on that same day or right after that, after the World Trade attacks, President Bush told us that the answer to all of this was to go out and go shopping, prove to those people, those terrorists, that you can't stop America, and what America's about is shopping, so go shop. Now, this was, to be fair, not exclusive to the Republicans. Patty Murray, my senator in Washington, encouraged a whole month of tax-free shopping called the Let's Go Shopping Act to try to get people into the stores. Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco at the time, printed a million shopping bags in the city and said, you know, America, open for business, and encouraged everybody to show that we weren't going to be put down by these terrorists. We were going to go out and shop till we drop.
Remember that well. We'll talk more about that when much more about the consumer culture and how he's been resisting it and advising other people to do so. John DeGraff is the author and creator of books and documentaries on affluenza. We'll come back and talk more about affluenza with John, and we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John DeGraff from the state of Washington, talking about affluenza, a term he admits he did not coin, but he certainly popularized through a series of books and documentaries on PBS. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about what he describes as the sickness of affluenza, seeking the trappings of affluence and not feeling that good when you get them. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the response that, first of all, the first affluenza book published right around 9/11, and then came this barrage of talk from political figures from both parties, as you pointed out, saying, let's go shopping. You know, America's open for business. Was there some pounding of head on desk as this patriotic reaction to 9/11 was rolled out?
Well, I suppose I don't remember exactly what my reaction was at the time, but it was pretty dismaying in a sense. And you know, I have to. There are a couple of things I want to clarify.
Sure.
And number one, the affluenza. Although all of us in our society, with the messages we receive and the idea that we get that the good life is the goods life, that the more stuff you have, the better you are. Who dies with the most stuff wins, and all this sort of stuff. That affects everybody, but everybody doesn't necessarily participate in this. And what we have seen, and particularly since 2000, and 2001, is that for a few people at the very top, the 1%, the 5%, whatever you want to, however you want to look at it, there's been an enormous rise in affluenza, in the money and the wealth of the society going to this small group of people. While for the vast majority of folks, they're finding that they need to work longer hours, get deeper into debt and everything, simply to keep the lifestyle that they had before. And so we have to be a little bit careful. In fact, my book and film were criticized at one point by Elizabeth Warren for not making the point that this was a very unequal sort of distribution, and that while that affluenza didn't affect our whole society in the same way. And I want to acknowledge that.
All right. That must be interesting company, though, to get criticized by Elizabeth Warren.
Well, you know, she was right. And certainly at the time, She was right. It wasn't that we were ignoring that completely, but I think our emphasis was on a little too much on the personal side of things, that, you know, people are kind of just caught up in this, when in fact we really have a social system and political laws and all of these things which absolutely encourage this sort of behavior. They encourage the increasing gap between rich and poor. They encourage all of us to have to strive to work longer, to get in debt, and all of these things in order to kind of keep up in this hamster's wheel of consumption. And they make it very difficult for the people on the bottom to do that in any way except by overworking and getting deeper into debt. And part of that, of course, then set off our foreclosures. We talked people into buying houses they couldn't afford. It wasn't just them. The banks were telling them, for example, oh, you make $30,000. Let's just say here on the loan that you make $60,000. How about that? And we'll give you the loan. You know, I mean, they were telling people literally to lie. And that was coupled with the fact that at the political level, we had just completely deregulated the banking system. We had broken down the barriers between commercial and investment banking through the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, and we had made it impossible for regulators to deal with the derivatives and the credit default swaps and all the crazy financial instruments by passing the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which literally said, you can't touch this stuff. The banks can do whatever they want. So this, while we in our book predicted that people would lose their homes to foreclosure, that they'd gotten too deep into debt, we didn't know what this would do to the economy because we weren't nearly as aware of the whole financial manipulation. We talk about that a lot more in the new version of the book.
Let me drop back and take a broader view here then. And John DeGraff's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about affluenza. How would you define affluenza? Because I've let myself define it a few times now, but I want to hear from you how you would describe it.
How I would describe affluenza?
Yeah.
Well, I think we call it something like a socially transmitted virus or disease of overconsumption, overwork, anxiety, and waste caused by the dogged pursuit of more. So it's kind of a funny, it's a tongue-in-cheek thing. The word affluenza is obviously a mix of affluence and influenza. It's meant to be partly tongue-in-cheek. The crazy thing is that it is now has now become taken seriously in a rather absurd way, which I'm sure you're aware of, with this case down in Texas, where a rich kid who killed four people while driving drunk literally escaped prison and got therapy in very rich setting and probation because his lawyer and psychologist argued that he had affluenza, that his parents had not taught him a sense of responsibility. Now, everybody jumped on that, including Rush Limbaugh on the right, saying, oh, my God, this is a terrible miscarriage of justice. Indeed, it was. But the point was that this is very consistently going on all the time. We've been favoring the rich for 30 years in this society in a big way, letting them off the hook for all kinds of things. And what we didn't acknowledge, what none of these people acknowledged, is that there's a grain of truth in this and that our whole society, in fact, has been behaving in a totally irresponsible way when it comes to the pursuit of wealth and its impacts on people and its impacts on the environment. And we've been doing that for a long time now. We need to shine a light on our society as a whole to see what kind of behaviors and policies are driving this sort of consumer behavior and greed.
That Texas case that you talk about then is interesting in a number of ways, because if, in fact, Rush Limbaugh was talking about it, I'm sure he found a way to blame it on liberals and Democrats, because that's just what he does.
But the fact that
there's obviously room to criticize it from the other side, which raises the larger question about whether the desire to get off the gerbil wheel of consumerism crosses ideological lines.
I think that the desire to get off it does cross ideological lines. Although I certainly, when it comes to political commentators, Rush Limbaugh at one point announced himself, and he had a whole series of ads calling himself the cure for affluenza. It was kind of nice even to be recognized by Rush Limbaugh in this regard, because it meant that what we were doing was at least being taken seriously by those folks. But what Limbaugh said essentially was, I'm the cure for affluenza. You know what the cure for affluenza is? Forget about it. Because when you consume a lot, you're just helping the economy grow, you're doing the right thing, you're making our businesses strong, etc., and all this affluenza kind of stuff is claptrap from these liberals and so forth. So certainly from that standpoint, there was more support from the liberal side. In terms of individuals, I think a lot of conservatives get this message. Some of them really believe that conservatism is about conserving things, you know, what a concept. But I think that's right. You know, it should be about conserving things. And our affluenza-afflicted society is not about conserving things at all. It's about using them as fast as possible, as becoming as addicted as possible to them, using them fast and throwing them away.
John DeGraff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the creator of the PBS documentary Affluenza and the book now about to be released in a new edition on affluenza. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Ann in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John DeGraff.
Thank you. This is very much a guest whose philosophy intertwines with mine. I'm a woman who hates to shop. Most of my wardrobe is old enough to vote. I use a bicycle around town for transportation. And it seems to me that the field of economics is totally based on a fantasy, because how can you have unlimited material growth on a limited planet? And isn't this some form of psychosis?
It's an interesting question. Psychosis. All right. So interesting, infinite material growth or infinite economic growth when we have a planet, obviously.
Well, no, not
planet
economic
resources.
Growth, because a lot of economic growth doesn't depend on material. I mean, look at all the financial manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
But material growth depends upon our planet, and we live on a finite planet.
All right. Thanks for that, Anne. Appreciate it. So, John, what do you think? Psychosis?
Well, you know, I think of it as this virus, in a sense, that's going on. You can think of it as a psychosis as well. It's not doing us a lot of good. I think that material growth, I would agree with the caller. I think economic growth, even the financial growth, tends to stimulate material growth, which is, in the long run, unsustainable. So there seems to be a connection there. It's complex, and I have another book called What's the Economy For Anyway that sort of goes into some of those issues. But one of the things we hear from both political parties, and the Democrats are also guilty of this, is that the answer to everything is to grow the economy, more growth, and so forth. This is really puts off the real question of how we distribute things and how we make sure we're taking care of those folks having a hard time at the bottom. And so we are now cutting food stamps, cutting unemployment, all these kind of things, while we cut the taxes for billionaires. This is really crazy. This is only encourages the problem of affluenza, and it is absolutely unsustainable, the levels of consumption. When we think about the fact that in the last 50 some years alone, or at least the time since World War II, we have consumed more resources than all of human beings who ever lived in all of history before that consumed. We have reduced our fossil fuels, our soils, our fisheries, and other resources by at least half. We have accounted for the loss of countless species, and we are dramatically changing the climate. Now, all this has happened in a blink of an eye in geological time. And there are people who believe that what we've been doing for this last 60, 70 years can go on forever. We not only consider them intelligent, reasonable, competent people, they run our government, they run our universities, they run our corporations. But in fact, they are stark raving mad. We cannot grow on like this.
Let us take another call. Let's go to Boyd in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to John DeGraff of the Affluenza Books and TV show.
Good morning.
Hi.
I think one of the things you're not noticing real clearly is the power and the ever-increasing power of advertising. There are more millions and billions spent in research and making advertising more effective, that the majority of American consumers make no decisions. They are run by advertising.
You mean they're actually controlled by the advertising? They have no choice in the matter?
Absolutely.
Interesting concept.
And I put 2 years in advertising, and I put subliminals in advertising, and I felt the impact of the subliminals on myself, and then I quit.
Really? Even after you created the messages, they still worked on you?
That's a fact.
Wow. That's an interesting story. Thanks for that, Boyd. Appreciate it. Let's get some response from John DeGraff.
Well, I generally agree with that. In fact, I haven't ignored advertising at all. In both my film and my book, there's a whole lot of focus on the impact of advertising. I wouldn't say that people are totally controlled by advertising, but I would certainly say that it has a huge influence in our society in the way that the caller mentioned. And I don't disagree with him, and I do. I think if he checks the book out and the film, he'll see how much attention is given to the impact of advertising in our society.
Is that one of the things that makes it so hard for people to stop being good little consumers, or good big consumers for that matter, is that there's always this constant barrage of messages that says, you know, this is consumption is good?
Well, it's certainly part of it. You know, I think there are other factors. I think the growing inequality, for example, actually pushes this kind of behavior, because what we're seeing, it used to be, the whole line used to be keeping up with the Joneses. Now, in the 50s, when that line developed, or the 60s, the Joneses were the folks that lived next door. They drove a Chevy, you drove a Chevy, and you kept up with the Joneses. It was a fairly modest kind of lifestyle. Now, the Joneses, in the eyes of people, are the folks they see in the ads, the folks they see on TV, and so forth, the super rich, the very rich in our society. Though their lifestyle is pushed at us constantly. So there's more of a sense that I've got to have that kind of lifestyle. I've got to consume these sort of products. The problem is, short of course, all the environmental negative impacts, but the social impact is that these people have no way to do that because they haven't seen their incomes rise, and many of them have seen their incomes fall over the past couple of decades. So the only way that they can keep up at all, that they can consume as they were or remotely the way they were, again, is to get deeper into debt, credit card debt, mortgage debt, all of those things. And secondly, to work longer hours. And I think one of the most pernicious impacts of our particular society is the overwork in America and its impact on our health and so forth. I'm currently working on a bill in the Washington State Legislature that would, for the first time in American history, mandate paid vacation. We are one of only 5 countries in the world, for example, that have no law requiring paid vacation for workers. We hope to change that in Washington State to be a bellwether state in turning that around. But that's just one example. We can look at so many ways in which Americans are overworking, overstressed. Their health is hurting from this when you compare us to Europeans, for example.
And yet what they have to reach for seems to be a higher minimum than used to be the case for previous generations. In fact, you mentioned in the book Affluenza about Levittown, New York, where I spent the first 13 years of my life.
Oh.
And the fact that the houses didn't have to be that big for families of 4, and ours certainly wasn't. But now, a family, you know, of 2 with a child on the way, it's like 2,500 square feet at a minimum.
Yeah, well, the average new home now is close to 2,500 square feet. The average new home at the time of Levittown was more like 800 square feet. So you can see the difference. It's a tripling of house sizes. At the same time, as you correctly pointed out, family sizes are getting smaller. There are fewer children in these homes and so forth. But, you know, we also have a great deal of deprivation and poverty in this country. I mean, we have the highest rate of poverty in the industrial world. We have the highest rate of children's poverty, people who are hurting. We have 4 empty houses in this country that are used as second homes or third or fourth homes by people, 4 times as many of those than we have homeless people. So these are the kinds of things that we don't think about.
We have an email here from Jan, no location given. She asks, are you familiar with Reverend Billy and his Stop Shopping Choir that has traveled across the country spontaneously preaching and singing the message to stop shopping in malls and public venues?
I am familiar with him, and I think he's very clever and very funny, and I appreciate what he's trying to do. My approach also includes humor. I'm not as funny as he is, but it does also include humor. I think both the film and the book are relatively funny, and that's been one of their appeals. But I am, also interested in, I'm particularly interested in the policies that impact this. And moving to policies that would give us more choice to work less and consume less. And Europe is full of these kinds of policies, and I write about those in great detail in the new book. It's much easier in Europe to decide, I don't want to consume that much. I'd rather work less. I'd rather have more leisure time. I'd rather spend more time with my family. I'd rather spend more time out in nature. To make those choices and not be penalized with a complete loss of one's livelihood.
Because the social safety net is that much better in Europe?
Because the social safety net is much better, and the laws also really encourage people to work only as much as is healthy for them.
We'll come back and talk more to John DeGraff about affluenza and possible cures for it, at least treatments for it. And we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with John DeGraff and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is John DeGraff. He is the creator of the TV documentary and the book Affluenza. There's a new edition of Affluenza hitting the bookstores anytime now. And John DeGraff is our guest in the exchange to talk about the problems of affluenza, in which we seek the trappings of affluence and don't seem very happy when we get it. Plus, we work too hard to get there in the first place. Our phone number is on the exchange to join this discussion, 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Stefano Bartolini, the Italian economist, is mentioned in one of the editions of the book, and he's pretty much working right up your alley, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. He has a book. It hasn't come out in English yet. I think it's supposed to soon, but I keep thinking that, and it hasn't happened. University of Pennsylvania is publishing the English language edition. The book is called Manifesto for Happiness, and it was a bestseller in Italy. Stefano is an economist at the University of Siena, and he argues, the chapters of his book is called America, the Example Not to Follow. And he argues that, in fact, the greater economic growth, the faster economic growth in the United States compared to most European countries, is really not a sign of economic dynamism. It's a sign of social decay. And what Bartolini says is that as we lose environmental amenities and common space and other things and the opportunity to enjoy those things, as we lose social connection and become more separated from each other, as we work longer and longer hours to buy more and more things, further isolating us from each other, we buy that stuff back in terms of private goods. So we try to get to gain back the sense of social connection by buying something, because the ads say, buy this thing and you'll have friends, buy this thing and you won't be lonely. We try to get access again to the nature we've lost by flying a long way to a tropical paradise where things are pristine. All of this increases the rate of economic growth in a real way, but it does not increase our social or environmental well-being, and it actually makes us feel worse, makes us feel less happy. And in the course of it, it also destroys our health and our connections further and our environment.
So, John, what's the alternative you advocate then? I mean, is there an overall system you're looking at here that you would say we need to move to, or just a change in individual behaviors? How do we accomplish getting ourselves treated for affluenza?
Well, you know, I do believe there's a lot we can learn from other countries in many ways, and I certainly believe that the Northern European countries are the place to look at this point in time. People will say, oh, Europe's a mess. Well, that's certainly not true for the Northern European countries. It's actually the European countries like Greece and Italy and Spain and Ireland, for example, that most followed the U.S. pattern. That is, they deregulated their banks, they had, you know, massive housing bubbles, all of these things. They went in a big way for the American model. Those are the countries that are having trouble. The countries with strong safety nets and with much greater equality, usually the result of taxation and other kinds of things, the Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands and so forth, Germany, are actually doing very well economically, and they're being asked to pay for the countries that followed us and are having trouble. Now, what do those countries do? Well, number one, they reduce the gap between rich and poor through policies that redistribute wealth in a significant way through a very strong social safety net and so forth. So these are countries that have the smallest gap between rich and poor. They also have the shortest working hours of any countries in the world, giving people much more leisure time to connect with others, to connect with nature and so forth. The Netherlands and Norway, in fact, have the shortest working hours in the world, and they also have some of the happiest people in the world. Holland is a good example. UNICEF just came out with a study, which I cite in the new version of the book, on child well-being in rich countries, and found that the United States was 26th out of 29 rich countries. We were only Latvia, Lithuania, and Romania did worse than the United States when it came to the well-being and quality of life of children. The number one country was the Netherlands, both in essentially all the objective factors, things like poverty and education and health and so forth, but also in the subjective sense that the children had about their own well-being. They ranked themselves number one. Their parents also ranked themselves number one in life satisfaction. Why is that? It's because the Netherlands has great laws that allow parents to work part-time and still make an adequate living and be able to spend time with each other and with their children. These kinds of policies in Northern Europe that are about egalitarianism, about quality of life rather than stuff, about lesser work time, more leisure time, these are the kind of things that counter affluenza and that give us a better life. We can learn a lot from this.
Do the laws in those countries include things like a higher minimum wage? Because the social safety net's there, so they have health care, but so they get paid more too, right?
They have free health care. Now they have higher taxes, but remember, they're starting at a much higher minimum. The minimum wage in the Scandinavian countries, for example, is about $20 an hour. In Denmark, I think it's even slightly higher than that. The minimum wage in Australia is $17 an hour. I was there a year ago. I went into a McDonald's and talked to a cashier and just asked her how much she made, finding it hard to believe that they had a minimum wage of $17 an hour. Their dollar is worth the same as ours. And she told me she made $18.50. She had started at $17, but she'd been there 2 years, and now she was making $18.50. This is a McDonald's cashier. So even if she has to pay higher taxes than Americans would, she still has more take-home money to do what she needs with it. So yes, minimum wages are higher. We need to address the terribly low minimum wage in this country. We're starting to do that in Seattle. Just yesterday, we swore in our first socialist city councilor, Sama Sawant, whose whole campaign has been run around a $15 minimum wage. I think we're going to get that pretty soon, actually, and I think that's a big step forward. But it's not just the minimum wage that we need. We also need some caps. We need some maximums. We need to say, you know, St. Augustine once said that a maximum income was as important as a minimum income. We need to reduce this horrible gap between rich and poor in this country, spread the wealth around. And I remember when Obama first said that in his first campaign, he got attacked for it. But that's exactly what we need to do. And we need to have some laws that protect people's time. We need to have laws which, you know, we do have in the city of Seattle that give people sick days, paid sick days when they're sick. We need laws that give people vacation time, as in Europe. We need paid family leave. One of the reasons other countries are doing much better with children than we are is that their parents get to spend time with them when they're born. In this country, one out of five Americans gets no paid, four out of five Americans get no paid maternity leave when they have a child, and their kids are put into daycare at a month. I mean, this kind of behavior is crazy. It is ludicrous, and it is going to eventually destroy our civilization.
John DeGraff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the creator of the documentary Affluenza and the book, now in another edition, about to be released, Affluenza. And here is Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi. Wow, thank you, Jeffrey. Another great show. And thank you, John, for continuing this whole line of inquiry that you started back in 97, because I've been on board with your thinking since then. Did my best to spread the word, and then, of course, it all got tanked when 9/11 happened. I'm just really happy that you're continuing to pursue this and develop your ideas, because I think this obsession with things is not just destroying our planet, but I think it's seriously eroding our capacity to grow in our compassion and humaneness as human beings. And a couple of comments about earlier callers, the one about advertising. Well, research shows that advertising only works if you constantly bombard people and if they're willing to be bombarded. So the defense is to stop watching the damn ads. And it's not perfect, but it's a good first line of defense. And I think people have a lot more control over that than they think they can. And I did a search in your new book. And I'm happy to see some references to the role that emotions play in motivating all our behaviors. Because the whole field of advertising is totally based on the manipulation of emotion. Mm-hmm. And the whole field of psychology is slowly realizing that we are emotional beings that rationalize our emotionally based decisions, not vice versa. And the other caller made some comment about economic thinking. The whole concept of, I think it was called homo economicus, something about if everybody is out for themselves, it results in the total good for all, is a joke. It's a premise that will be laughed out of any psychology 101 class. So I hope you will continue to do your work, and I will definitely continue to follow it.
Thanks. All right, Sandy, thanks for that. Appreciate it. John, where do you go from here then? I mean, you're obviously in different ventures now, doing more than just Affluenza. Tell us about the Happiness Initiative and Take Back Your Time.
Sure. A few of us founded the Happiness Initiative about 3-4 years ago, trying to build on what last caller really pointed out, that psychology is increasingly, positive psychology, discovering that what makes people happy is not more and more stuff, is not greed, is not looking out for number one. It's sharing, it's gratitude, it's social connection, it's time in nature, it's all of these other kinds of things which we're rapidly losing to affluenza, I would argue. So we started the Happiness Initiative with the idea that we ought to be measuring happiness and well-being rather than simply GDP. And that idea comes initially from this tiny country called Bhutan in Asia.
We've talked about the Gross National Happiness Index here on the program before, but it does seem to be catching on in other countries further west.
It is, yeah. I mean, slowly, but I had an opportunity to go to Bhutan a year ago as an advisor to their government and with a number of people from other countries, and I was very impressed with what they're trying to do. I mean, it's a series of stops and starts, and it changes, and Bhutan is certainly no perfect place by a long shot. It has lots of problems. But I think the important thing is that it's trying to look to a different direction. It's trying to measure something different, well-being instead of simply economic growth. And that's an important lesson. The Happiness Initiative, we have a survey. It takes about 15 minutes, and you can find it at happycounts.org. And when you take that survey, when you finish, you'll get a score in 10 key areas of life that scientists know are important for happiness. And I suggest that people do that. It's kind of fun. We're also working with communities around the country to measure happiness and well-being as a community. And it seems like Ashland would be a wonderful community to do something like this, because you are. It's a great community down there, and I'm very, very aware of that. So we're working with colleges. We're working with communities. You can find all that online at Happy Counts. My other work has been Take Back Your Time, which is getting at this idea of how do we reduce overwork and the enormous stress that we get. One cardiologist friend of mine calls overwork, stress from overwork, the new tobacco in America, and says it produces the same impact that smoking does on our arteries and so forth. So how do we reduce that? What kinds of policies and what kinds of changes in behavior can give us more leisure and more time? I just finished a new documentary for public television here in Seattle called The Great Vacation Squeeze about the need for more vacation time in America. And as I mentioned, I'm working with a state representative here in Seattle on a bill which she's introducing next week into the Washington legislature that would, for the first time, require paid vacations for workers, the first time in America, other than Puerto Rico, which requires 3 weeks already.
You know, it does seem like over time, as benefits get trimmed and things like paid vacation become, in fact, I worked for a company that took back a week of vacation. I'd stayed there long enough to earn four, and they took one back and made it three.
Right.
We seem to put up
all
with,
over.
Right. And it seems like we deal with this and go, okay, well, whatever, because we still have jobs. Is that essentially what it gets down to for a lot of people?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of fear in America. People are willing to accept all kinds of things because of the fear that a system that has no essential social safety net, like in Europe, and so forth, conjures up in all of us. And it's a well-founded fear. We realize we can lose our livelihoods, that we simply have to do what's required of us, and we don't understand that what we need to do is to act collectively and politically to change the rules that make that the case. Now, you know, vacation time, all of these things are being lost. There's no reason for this. There's absolutely no economic reason why the world's richest country has to have less vacation time than virtually any other country in the world, even many poor countries. I mean, that is scandalous. And we need to start to change those things right now, and we need not back down from people who say, oh my gosh, you're gonna, you know, kill the goose that laid the golden egg. I mean, what golden egg? It laid an egg. This system has laid an egg, but it's not golden.
Well, the new edition of Affluenza will be in the store shelves pretty much any time now. Is that right?
It should be. I've gotten copies sent to me, so they were mailed out at the same time as to the bookstore, so Hopefully it will be, and you can also find it online.
All right, John DeGraff has been our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange, the creator of Affluenza, both in print and on the screen. Thanks so much for joining us today, John.
Thank you. Great pleasure. Keep up the good work.
All right, thanks. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange, we'll talk about more new laws for the new year in Oregon with State Representative Peter Buckley. In our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about attitudes about evolution and California splitting into six pieces. Well, that's on the table now, too. Then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of A Dreadful Deceit about views on race in America. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Dern, our student assistant, Reed Newland. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow at 8, and please have a great day.